Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Welcome to Face to Face. This is a show about change and about what's next. It's a show that wants to ask questions, peel back the layers of our average everyday experience, and go beyond scratching the surface. We interview amazing people with incredible ideas and stories who have done wild, weird, and wonderful things. Remember that imagination shared creates collaboration, and collaboration creates community, and community inspires social change. I'm David Peck, and this is Face to Face. So my next interview is another Hot Docs interview with Beatrice Bain and Rene Gebhardt, and we talk about their new film, The Artist and the Pervert. This is a fascinating film. It's a film about art and about music. It's a film about sexuality and voyeurism and about having a tiny existential crisis. And we talk a great deal about all of that. And we talk about love and relationships and how we get represented, how our understanding of power gets represented. We talk about cliched representation and why espresso machines actually might be inspirational to musicians and to us all. We talk about the power of the moment, and we talk about what real power actually is. We talk about something called spectralism and destructive desires and labels and how art and life truly are really complicated. This is a fascinating film. It is a film you're going to want to see. It's going to challenge you. It's going to push you. It's also going to affirm and delight you in a variety of interesting and artful and creative ways. So stay tuned. Coming right up, a conversation with Beatrice Bain and Rene Gebhardt. Don't forget davidpecklive.com for more information about my speaking and writing, and also facetofacelive.ca for many other interviews with filmmakers and artists and philosophers and writers about moving the needle just a little bit more on a thing called social change. Coming right up, The Artist and the Pervert, and Beatrice Bain and Rene Gebhardt. Well, welcome to Face to Face. We're joined by two very special guests here with us today, two filmmakers here in Toronto. Welcome to Toronto to you both, to Beatrice Bain and Rene Gebhardt. Did I get that close?
It was close enough. That's
close,
fine.
Close enough. Excellent. All right. No need to correct me right out of the gate. That's a good start. We're going to talk about your new film here at Hot Docs in Toronto, The Artist and the Pervert. And already people's ears are perking up, I'm sure. They've probably maybe read a little bit of the bio. Maybe they've watched the trailer online and they're about to hear us go deep into the film. First of all, welcome to Toronto.
Thank you.
Yeah, and congratulations on the film. So where do you start with this? I know the New York Times had something to do with maybe how we're winding up here today having this conversation, but I'd love to hear a little bit more about that evolution of the story, because it's pretty fresh, right? It's pretty recent.
It's rather recent, yeah. So we started filming 2 years ago when basically the New York Times article came out, and I was procrastinating on Facebook like everyone else. And I saw it, and I was like, wow, this is interesting. Because I had like a specific reaction to it, and it was quite a judgmental reaction. And then I stopped myself, and I was like, what am I doing here? I don't even know these people. Why would I judge them? And then I saw the comments, and everybody was doing it. Everybody was judging from very different perspectives, but everyone had an opinion on those two people immediately. And I found that really interesting. So I showed it to Rene, and he was the same. He thought, like, this is so weird. Why would everyone just like, it's a tiny article, it's not that much, why would everybody like put their stuff on it? Because it became like this political thing, it's a sexual thing. Everyone judged them at the same time, and we wondered, how does this look like on a day-to-day basis? Because that's like a BDSM relationship. It's 24/7, so it's all the time. It's not in the bedroom, like many people think.
Right.
It's not just everywhere and all the time.
It's not compartmentalized in that sense.
Exactly.
This is actually a way of life. And I thought it was really interesting that you make that distinction and you refer to it as a 24/7.
Yes.
I don't think I've heard of that before
in that sense.
And it's a real commitment.
It is a real commitment. And personally, the first thing I thought was, like, this sounds really, really stressful.
What do you do the entire day?
How do you do BDSM for 24 hours a day, 7 days a week? And we just wanted to see how that looks like and what is the actual story behind all the buzzwords.
Well, and what makes this really even more fascinating and I would say layered is the artistic edge to both of both Milena and Georg. And their lives. I mean, what is the line about Georg's composing and his music? One of the greatest or one of the most performed artists of the 21st century, I believe.
He was just voted one of the most important living composer.
Living composer. So, and then somebody else in the film, I think, says something to the effect of the most performed.
One of the most performed as well, yes.
Right, who's still alive.
Yes.
Who actually gets to enjoy
his
audiences listening to his work. It's fascinating. So small New York Times piece, your judgment. I'm interested in going there a little bit because I'm sure that a lot of people probably are going to feel the same way. I mean, they're going to read the title of the film. I would imagine a lot of people will just flip over. Oh, I'm not going to go see that. I already know what that's about.
Mm-hmm. How was that with you when you saw it? What was your first thing you think about?
Well, my first reaction, because I guess I'm doing a lot of these interviews, I'm always looking for something a little bit different, something interesting, something that's not going to necessarily cross a line, but I wouldn't mind moving the line every now and then, mm-hmm. if you know what I mean, and being challenged. And so for me, it drew me in, actually. And I would think a lot of the Hot Docs crowd and quite a few of my listeners, too, will be intrigued.
Yes.
Right? I think there's a sense of curiosity there.
Well, I think
my question I have so many questions, but one of them is, why would you want to live in a 24/7 relationship like this? You know? And you do unpack that in the film, and you do it well.
I think that the first thing is the word pervert is really interesting. Because that really triggers a lot of people
in
either a good or a bad way, but everyone immediately has a reaction to
the
word.
And we don't hear it till way late in the film.
Exactly.
Right?
Because that's not the point. But it's interesting that usually, I mean, from the experience we had right now, people come in with very voyeuristic ideas of what this is going to look like. And at the end of the film, they usually are either really surprised, they're very moved, or they have like a tiny existential crisis. Because the major question the film is asking is the one, are you living the life that you actually want to live?
And I think also the question about, like, how is it to live in a 24/7 BDSM relationship is also similar to how do you live 24/7 with any person if you are in a relationship, because maybe the setting is different. It's not like that special if you think about, like, you have to make commitment with another person you love, and you decide how do you want to live together, and that could have many forms, and like, is it BDSM, or is it if you live as a gay couple, or there are many ways to live.
Well, and I think for me, I think that's one of the things the film. I mean, any great sort of doc film has so many layers and so many ways it could go, and it's going to mean different things to different people, obviously. And you bring that out too with some of the quotes, I guess, from the Facebook pages, I suppose, or the responses to the New York Times piece. Some pretty visceral, angry, almost reactions.
Oh yeah, plantation owners and
yes,
stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, they went all the way. That was crazy and incredible.
Yeah. Yeah, but it's going to push that. It's going to, like you say, I'd love to hear more about that existential crisis. Did you find either of you were were running up against questions that you were a bit uncomfortable with as you were making this film?
Well, I mean, there's maybe we have to talk about what kind of questions we're tackling. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's the question of race because it's an interracial couple. There is also the question of BDSM and role play because he is the master, she's the slave. And then we have another question that's political because she calls herself a slave, but she's African American and he's white. So that's a whole different set of issues.
Yeah. Then there's really another one.
Yes. Then there's another one because he comes from a Nazi family in Austria, which makes things even more complicated.
It sure does.
And then we have the issue of gender and feminism because she submits to a man and they both call themselves feminists.
They're both called themselves feminists.
So that's the whole topic we have. And this is kind of what we try to tackle.
And they're both artists in their own sort. She's a storyteller. She's a comedian. She's a writer.
That's another thing, right?
So it's working on a whole lot of levels.
Yes, and we found that we could work with most of those levels, except for maybe one, which actually is on the artistic side, because she is now spending a lot of time serving him, because this is a service-related relationship.
Right.
And she is an amazing artist, but there's, you know, you can share many things, but the one thing you can't, you know, share is time. She only has 24 hours a day. So if she spends so much time serving him, what happens with her art? You know, this is one of the questions that we really came up with again and again, thinking about all the art that might be missed, but also she's happy with it.
Right.
So
During the process of the documentary, there were also the point where they came together with doing art together, which was... also really interesting to see how her art changed when she works together with Georg.
Interesting.
And they made together a piece where in the end she's standing on a stage in Vienna.
Oh, it's a beautiful scene.
Yeah.
It's a beautiful piece too. I mean, and I don't know the music and I don't know her work at all, but it's interesting how you, and I don't know, I'm sure it was intentional, but out of the gate it's sort of brash and she's in your face. And then we end with this, I thought, very different person, like on the stage and the presentation, the poetry of it, the emotion. It just really, I mean, I think drew me in, but I think it drew the audience in as well.
And I find it also interesting. It seems like she's changing his art with her personality and with the relationship they have, and also when they do this thing together, it was also like completely different to what people maybe knew of Georg's art before, because
some might actually, you know, like you bring it out that a few of the people that you interview talk about how sweet they are together and how loving they are, and they talk about how I love you and I love you, and you have all these sort of lovely moments in the film, and but I was just going to say that some people would say that might be a definition of love, the degree to which you actually have an impact on the person that you're with. So your comment about she's changing his art, he's, you know what I mean? It just shows that level that they've actually been able to get to, which I would probably argue a lot of people aren't able to land in that space.
Yeah, there's another layer on that, because despite the fact that we were kind of like wondering about, you know, the time frame in her arts and if she can do anything, the interesting part of that is they're in a relationship that's very common, because here's a woman who gives up a lot of her time and freedom to serve a man, which, I am sorry, happens a lot in non-consensual ways in many relationships that are considered normal.
Right.
You know,
right.
She has a baby, so she stays at home and he goes to work, etc. So they're doing the same, but they're doing it consensually.
Right.
She agrees to that. They thought about that. They do it because they want to do it, because they get something out of it. So this is the really interesting thing, because in many levels, this is a relationship that functions like many other relationships, except for the point of consent. They actually know what they're doing and they thought about it. And that's really interesting.
Yeah, and it's intentional, like you have pointed out several times. So the 24, this is a way of life.
Yes.
It's
a set of rules, basically.
It's a set of rules, which I'm sure some people, and I'm including myself, I kind of wondered at a couple points, is this just theater? Is this just theater? You know, is this a part of the art? You know, this 24/7 piece that they're
like a performance
yes,
piece, you mean?
It's a performance piece.
That would
piece.
Be even more exhausting, wouldn't it?
It really
that would be horrible.
Would. It really would. Yeah. That's
an interesting question. Like, where does the art start and where does it end?
Yes, yes. And, well, this is the shots of him composing, you know, with no clothes on and she's looking for the shoes. I mean, it's just, it's absurd on one level and entertaining on another, and just, this is just the stuff of life. This is how they live, right? And don't we all have our own sort of idiosyncrasies and oddities about the way we do things, right?
And also, just imagine somebody would come to your house and document you and your wife for a week.
So, okay, I need to go there. Why did they say yes?
Because we asked nicely, I guess. We went online and we made a specific point of not contacting them on like Facebook, but we went to FetLife, which is a BDSM platform, and they're both on that. And we chatted them up there, and we're like, "Hi, we would love to document this because this is really interesting." And because we asked nicely, and I think because we showed that we kind of understand what's going on by choosing the specific platform, they agreed to meet. So 2 weeks later, we met in Munich, and we had a very crazy and very nice evening of sharing dinner and just talking about their life. And I think we all of us clicked, and we understood the thing we want to do is not the usual treatment of BDSM, which is always in like a freakish kind.
Right, right.
You know, it's always like, look at those freaks doing the freaky stuff. And we were not interested in that.
I think we made clear that we are not interested in making a freak show or something.
Exploiting them.
But yeah, I think we were really honest all together and said like, yeah, we don't want this. We don't want to make like a view from outside and look at this perverts or something. We wanted to show and to see who are these people and how do they live. And I think, yeah, we clicked very well together. So they agreed.
Because, I mean, this is also a question of representation, which is one of the big questions in film right now. Who gets represented and how? And if you look at any kind of...
Now you're talking about power dynamics.
Yes, yeah. In many ways.
In many ways,
but if you just look at how are people who are older represented, are they actually represented? How are people who are into BDSM represented? The answer is they're either not even there, or it's usually a really horrible, super cliche representation. And this is exactly what we did not want to do. I just really wanted to see the people behind it, like the actual people, without judgment. And this is why also this film doesn't have a voiceover. We're not telling their stories. We tried to get out of the story as much as possible ourselves as filmmakers. Because we did not want to be the people who tell somebody else's story, because there's so much marginalization that it's so much better if they tell their own story.
Sure.
So this is what we try to do.
I want to talk a little bit about Georg's childhood, because it's so fascinating. But I have to say, laugh out loud moment with the espresso machine. Yeah. How much inspiration does he get for his music from the espresso machine itself? Like that overextended sort of what's it called? The music is tonal.
It's help me out here. It's microtonal music. He's also sometimes considered a spectralist, but he hates that.
Spectralist. Neuronal resonance was the phrase I never heard before.
Yes, I mean, this is really heady music, and it's really interesting in terms of physics, because it usually comes together in a space.
The only thing I could think of musically for me, and this might just show my own sort of framework here, very close-minded musical framework, but Philip Glass came to mind. A little bit.
Yes.
A little bit.
I see your point.
You know, almost that surreal. And I love Philip Glass. And it really abstract.
Yes.
Kind of, where is this taking me? And I think for me, the question is, why would somebody compose this music?
And how? My question is how?
Well, and, you know, it's fascinating.
We watched him for hours and hours, and I still don't understand what he's doing. So, but the espresso machine is really interesting, because we actually talked about this a couple of weeks ago, and he actually mentioned the noises of this espresso machine, and they're horrible noises.
It's fascinating, one of the
inspirations.
Oh, okay.
He's actually inspired by noises that machines make.
How could he not be, really?
And it was really interesting. He told us like that we put it really well together in the whole movie, like also this machine sounds. And but he didn't tell us about this during the filmmaking. But it was surprising for us to know afterwards, like yeah, this is really some kind of inspiration I get from this sound.
Well, and what's so funny to me is it's about, again, what you sometimes you notice. And so, and this is what about a great film is for me. It brings out things like, that's the wonder, isn't it, of just the stuff we miss. Who knew that an espresso machine actually could be an inspiration, right? And sometimes you just got to step. And isn't this about being a better parent, being a better lover, being a better friend, a better teacher? It's about noticing the little things. It's about listening, right? Yes. Anyway, it's just comical to me that an espresso machine is what sort of brings that to the surface. A remarkable background. He talks about his parents running from his parents' venomous ideas and his past, and you sort of start us out thinking that maybe he had a normal childhood, maybe, and then we meet his mother and we hear some of her ideas and the ideology and how deep it goes still after all these years, but then you'd sort of juxtapose that against the idea that, hang on a minute, that's not necessarily, that didn't have a direct connection to anything else necessarily, and yet there seems to be a link, I think. Can you help me with that? Is there a
link between his childhood abuse and his BDSM relationship, or what do you mean?
Just the way that our past informs our present, and then, you know, and connects to our future. You know, Kierkegaard said, "You look back and you start to understand." Right? You see some of those. Oh, okay, now I get it. I see where my father, like the line of his father saying, "You're a failure. Basically, you're never going to amount to anything." And I just wonder how some of that played out in my life, and I wonder if you guys had any insights, because you do suggest that it's not necessarily connected, right? I think you do, or at least you raise the question.
Well, the question needs to be raised because it's so easy, and it's one of those typical things to say that people so who practice cliche. BDSM are, of course, abused people.
They were abused, right?
And I'm sorry, that's just lame. That it's very lazy too, in too terms simple. Of psychology. Even it's super lazy. But I think what he learned in his childhood is what power means. I think that's the most important thing. What does power mean, and who is actually powerful? Because the interesting thing is, if we want to go there, if you argue with Hannah Arendt, one of the great exactly, the one that that uses force is not the one who's in power. If you have to use force on somebody, if you have to beat somebody, you're not the one in power. Because if you had power, you wouldn't have to beat the people. So, and I think this is something that he experienced from many, many sides. And he really thought about this for a very long time in terms of politics and Nazi politics, but also on a very personal level in terms of being a child that was beaten and abused on a daily basis. And I think he spent more than 40 years dealing with his past and really looking into this. He's still in that process.
Of course. And how can any of us really run? We don't run from it, right? We just learn how to, I hope, deal with it in a more meaningful way in whatever community we find ourselves in, I think. Or we try to forget it and we push it aside, which has probably consequences. Yeah, it doesn't work, exactly. But
the interesting thing is, now you would, like, if you think in cliches, you would think, like, of course he now has a wife who he occasionally spanks and beats because he was beaten as a child. This is his way how he deals with his childhood. But actually, that's not the case, because what he's doing with his wife is a whole different set of things that doesn't have anything to do with that. And right now, the way he deals with his past and childhood is he's going through a very interesting phase where he goes very deep into Nazi language, because his language, his Austrian-German language, is filled with words that were either invented or reshaped by the Nazis, and he's trying to kind of clean his language right now. So he's working on that kind of level. And that's what I'm saying. It's really lazy to think that this is why he's doing spanking. I mean, that's not how it works.
We like the easy answers too, right?
Of course.
It's also, he told that he had many problems to go into this BDSM thing because of his past, because he didn't want to be, for example, like the same like his father or mother was. Like, and he told about that he had to realize that, for example, spanking can also be an act of love.
He says that his father's beatings were without love, which I thought was a really interesting notion. That, well, the implication is that you can actually spank and do it lovingly.
And this is also like, to think about this is also like that there's spanking without love and there could be a spanking with love. This is also like one of the things when you think about the first time, this is really interesting.
Well, now we have to ask questions about consent as well, right? And what love really means and all of those things. Can you, in that same scene, he says, the 40 years made me think of it, transforming our destructing desires, did he call them, into love? Did he talk about destructive desires into love?
And this is the thing that you mentioned earlier. If you don't deal with your past and if you just, you know, put it aside or you try to ignore it, it usually transforms into very destructive things.
Yeah.
And his marriage with Melina is not his first marriage. It's number four. So he's dealing, not in the film, but as a person right now, he is dealing with the things he basically did in his other marriages where he couldn't be himself. Mm-hmm. And that is also a thing because he completely suppressed how he actually wanted to live. So those marriages ended up in like horrible ways. He hurt people. People hurt him. It was just, you know, the typical marriage and divorce horror stories. And they had something to do with him not being honest to himself. This is what he meant with the destructive force, that he doesn't have to do anymore and he could transform this into something loving and good.
Yeah, and to me, and I'm speaking from my own experience and so on here now, because now you talk about destructive desire. I see more of a link to the past with that kind of a thing. And the if the beatings, and this is a question in a sense too, rhetorically, but if the beatings had been with love, would he have been a different person, right? Would he have been able to create the art that he's even been able to create? I mean, these are really, right, where does that, that's been his way of expressing, of dealing with that 40 years of pain and anger and whatever, that he's, these venomous ideas, as he says. Mm-hmm. And I'm putting some words into his mouth here. I don't know, but I wonder, you know, that's been his way to heal.
That's true, but at the same time, now you're kind of, go like you're falling into the other cliche that art can only come from like horror stories.
Horrible
you
know, places.
That happy people can't do art and stuff. Right. So now you're falling into that trap.
You need razors in your wallet.
Yes, exactly.
Or in your purse, if you want to create art. Yeah, true. Yeah, fair enough.
And there's also this question, what is interesting, like people are saying now his music now sounds different, that now that he is together with Melina, and think like it sounds more positive and
interesting,
embracing, and interesting is also in this fact like if you ask Georg, he's saying like no, it's the same kind of music, it doesn't change, it's music is my language and the language maybe has a little bit a different dialect.
Sure.
But
a little different dialect, nice. I love the way I think a music critic at the beginning of the film talked about the tradition and how he plays with traditional ideas, which I think is what we're seeing when he's kind of, I don't know what he's doing. You even said you didn't know what he's doing and you followed him for quite a while, but is it drawing vectors on the music page? I mean, what is he doing with those notes?
Honestly,
anyway?
I don't know.
what it looked like to
me. It seems from the outside, it's a very complex structure that he's building, and I mean he's literally composing music, and in his head he's putting it together in a physical way. There's a piece right in the beginning, it's called Release, which is very heavy and very loud and really crazy. And this piece and other pieces that he's played, he even calculates that the instrument, if you play it for longer than half an hour, kind of gets out of tune. So he calculates that into the music so that it is exactly that's the way hilarious. He wants it to be. And that's the point where I'm just like, I'm out.
Yeah,
like, I don't know what you're doing. I understand the part of like being a genius
writer.
So when
does the bassoon go out of tune in relation to the viola? That's
I
what
have
I
no
know.
Idea.
Yeah.
And that's just, this is crazy and amazing. And
do you think he could teach?
Like he does teach.
Can he teach the music he's creating?
He is teaching. He's a professor at Columbia University, New York, and he's a professor in Graz, Austria, as well. And he's teaching composing. So, and he, from what we saw and heard, he's a really, really good teacher.
It seems to me it's the kind of thing you would have to be almost elbow to elbow like down with him on his knees, looking and to learn how to actually.
But this
do
is
it.
The you this know, is the interesting thing. He's a really good teacher and mentor because he's not teaching his way.
Right.
He is enabling others, and
right.
that's the point.
Nice.
I think.
Nice. Well, that's the point of the whole film, isn't it?
Kind
of,
yeah.
Yeah, this whole empowerment. Finding your own way.
And that this is also about power, because he could literally. He is in the power as a professor to put his ways on his students, and he doesn't.
And also in his own art, in Release, he has this thing with the calculation of the different tuning of the instruments, and at the same time, he writes this piece in a way to say the musicians, and at this point, you do something own, with your own breathing, and to develop... an own way to play from here.
In the context of the piece?
In this piece. Yeah.
There's a certain amount of freedom, yes. And he has a lot of pieces that are played in the dark.
Yes, I know.
So nobody
well,
sees
yeah.
anything, which makes things more complicated. I think this is where he is a little bit of a sadist,
right,
I have to say.
Right.
there's a weird power exchange right there. But there's and it was so interesting to see, because we asked him, how, if they don't see each other and they don't see what they're playing, how does this work?
How does that,
and
yeah.
it works by breathing and by breath. So somebody is breathing in a certain way, and people know, the second breath, I'm going to start with my thing, etc.
You must know Jonas Mekas, some of his work coming out of
yes.
New York back in the 60s. He was here a couple of years ago at Toronto International Film Festival, and somebody made a film of one of his books, I Had Nowhere to Go. And in the film, I was told by the publicist, you need to listen to this, and you need to turn off the lights and wear headphones. Because the director didn't want me to even see it in a screen. He wanted me to come to the theater. And there's a sequence that's about 7 minutes long. It's in complete darkness, and bombs are dropping, and guns are going off, and it's a very surreal experience. So immediately, I saw a bit of a connection there, and I wondered if he would refer to himself as an avant-garde kind of, you talk about him empowering his students to think on their own. Would he even want that label, to be put into that sort of category, if
well,
you will.
What we can tell you is
spectralist.
Yeah. Oh no. I think he despises labels. Any kind of label, no matter what the label is.
I bet.
And he is right, because any kind of label always puts you into this niche, and it's really hard to get out of this niche. And art and life, especially his, are very complicated and complex.
So good.
So I mean, this doesn't even work on any kind of way. No matter whether you talk about the composing or, his personal relationship, how are you going to put this in any kind of...
And isn't that what racism and sexism is really fundamentally built on?
Exactly.
Right? Labels. Right? It's yes. It's about structure. It's about seeing something in one particular way, not a way of seeing.
And thinking that you know exactly how things
right.
work. And,
right.
Usually you don't know anything about...
What did you learn about them that you didn't expect? Anything sort of surprise you along the way? And sadly, we're going to have to wrap up the interview in a couple of minutes here, but I'd love to hear if there were any sort of surprising revelations as you got to know them a little more, because I would imagine you got to know them pretty well.
You mean apart from filming for 2 weeks and then he just casually mentions his Nazi family?
That's a bit of a surprise.
We were like, oh, okay, okay. That's now we have to go to Austria, and your mom's still alive. We totally want to talk to her. I mean, literally this entire film is very organic because we went there. We started filming in their house for a week just to see how do they live. And the funniest part is she's the slave, but she doesn't get up before 1 p.m. There's no slaving before
that's
1 p.m.
That's a lazy slave.
No, that's just she would whoop your ass.
That's right. I bet she would. Yeah,
I mean, this is so funny because we're like, oh, Master Schleif, yeah, but on her own terms.
That's right.
So,
I loved her definition too, and I'll find it in a second. So keep going. But there was dynamic.
We were there, and we just spent time with them, and and then we had this my family is full of Nazis, and we're like, oh, okay. And then she told us about her past, because she's an alcoholic.
Yes.
And she overcame that in a very dramatic way. She almost died. We didn't know that either. They kind of just, all these things just kept coming up.
Well, yeah, and isn't that the beauty of any relationship too, right?
Exactly, because it would be strange.
You peel back the layers.
Yeah, even for documentary filmmakers, it would be weird that you just throw your entire life out there and you're just here's my life. and this is not how we worked together. We both, you know, thought it's better to develop this organically and just see what they come up with and then follow that lead. And this is literally how the entire film was kind of made.
What surprised me also was, like, if you think about the story and the beginning, how we made it, like when we started, when the people at first are really judgmental and really saying awful things about them. But the more you talk about the story, the more you dive in and show the people about the story, the more open the people get, is like the feeling I have about this. Like, for example, when we had our world premiere and the film was over and the Q&A started, like no person left the room. It was like the
so there were no walkouts.
Zero, no, and that never happens.
No walkouts, and also the Q&A was really long, and the people were really curious and open and wanted to know more. And I think this is also, if you hide yourself, there's and if you open up, maybe more this, if you open up, then the people you talk about. If you open up yourself, the people you talk with, I think open up themselves too, and I think that could start a lot of conversations and understanding.
Absolutely. I mean, I think what I'm hearing you talking about is authenticity, right? And this is back to your sort of full circle, the existential crisis. I mean, isn't that what we're all sort of struggling with? Is being more, I hope, being more authentic.
And just really, like, becoming just really humans. Being honest with yourself. Like, the question is and remains, the entire question of the film is, are you living the life that you actually want to live? Or are you being scared and anxious?
Right. Yeah.
And if so, why?
Yeah, and why wouldn't you? Why wouldn't you just be yourself?
And what are you not doing because you're afraid? I mean, everything is a choice, it seems to me, right? Yeah. Even if there's things we ignore. I love that you, and maybe we can kind of wrap it up, but... I love that you end the film with dedicated to lovers everywhere. Is that right? Is that the that is the
yes.
line, right? It's and I think there's a authenticity to the film that clearly has already resonated, and I would imagine is going to continue. What after a film? This is your first full length feature, isn't it?
This is our first film.
Well, welcome to filmmaking.
Yeah, thank you.
It's hilarious. So what's the plan? I mean, are you stepping now into a festival sort of tour, or do you know what's next? What's the...
Well, this is also a really interesting thing in terms of, are you living the life you really want to live in, in terms of power and other dynamics? We literally just made this film because we wanted to tell the story, which is something that in the film industry seems to be very odd. Because people don't know what to do with us. This film has no funding. We just made it because we wanted to make it. And now we experience many people that are really puzzled by that. Because where is, like, our big marketing strategy? Where is the whole thing?
Right. You know, you mean you don't have a public engagement strategy?
No, none of that. No, we do that now, but we do it because we want to do it and we want people to see the movie and talk about it.
Sure,
that's
sure.
Of course. But, you know, there's no production company behind this. It's literally just two people that made a movie.
Wow.
And this is really interesting. And yes, we are interested in getting the film out so a lot of people can see them. Which is now is film festivals. We're going to have a film festival tour worldwide that we're just kicking off right now. With Thessaloniki was the world premiere, and now Hot Dogs. And then we'll see if we will, you know, have it on VOD or any other kind of thing where people can actually watch it.
Right.
But apart from that, that's all.
Well, thank you for making the film and for adding to the conversation on love and relationships. And I mean, we barely scratched the surface.
So I have a question for you though, before we wrap this up.
Yeah.
You watched the film and you're a lover. So what do you think about your life? Are you living the life you really want to?
Am I living the life I really want to? Most days, I think, is my answer. But I can't say that I'm living it every day. No. And I think my biggest challenge is, and I see this in my kids, and my kids and my wife, Elizabeth, are helping me along in this, and that's being present. I think being present is living your life to the fullest and being here instead of being, you know, in my next interview or oh gee, what are we doing tonight again? No, I'm here, I'm present here with you, and I was. And so it's a challenge.
It's the hardest thing. Yes.
It's a daily. Thanks for the question, and thank you for your time today. I hope I get this right, Renee Gephardt and yes. Beatrice Bien.
Yes, thank you for having
talking,
us.
Talking about their film, The Artist and the Pervert, here in Hot Docs today. Thanks for your time today.